This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton with episode 90. First up tonight is an episode of Murder at Midnight from the 16th of December of 1946. It's called Murder is a Lonely Business. And it's another one of those stories about how crime really never completely pays off, even when you get away with it. But Fred and Grace do. They get away with the murder of Uncle Fred, and they get all of his money. But Fred, in particular, is never able to shake the feelings of guilt. He crawls into a bottle, and his health gets worse, and his marriage basically goes to hell. You know, everything just kind of runs on down, and pretty soon, Fred is left with this run-down feeling.
Murder at midnight.
Let go of my arms. I'll give you money. All the money you want.
No, Fred, no!
You monsters! I'll make you pay for this.
Midnight, the witching hour when the night is darkest, our fears the strongest, and our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes. How? You'll learn the answer in just a minute in Murder's a Lonely Business. Now, Murder at Midnight. Unusual stories of terror and mystery by radio's masters of the macabre. This tale, A Study of Murder in Duet, is by William Morwood. Its title, Murder's a Lonely Business. At a cemetery, a burial is taking place.
Forasmuch as it hath pleased Almighty God of his great mercy to take unto himself the soul of our brother,
the two chief mourners, Fred and Grace Tilson, stand beside the open grave.
Earth to earth,
and as he looks at his wife,
ashes,
bitter thoughts course through Fred's mind.
And sure and certain
look at her. Look at her standing there, dabbing her eyes with a handkerchief. Tears. Real tears after what she did. After what she made me do. She doesn't know what sincerity is, or love or pity either. She's hard. Hard all the way through. And I never knew. Never even suspected till. Till we killed him. Now, that's the way she acted. I'll never forget it. Never. A nightmare always. How can I go on living with her? How can I ever trust her again? What am I to do? Oh, Lord, I'd give anything for a drink.
To think I ever married a sniveling creature. I believe he's really crying, really sorry. As if he cared a hoop about his Uncle Edward outside of the money he could get out of him. He was ready enough to help put the old man out of the way the other night. Now his nerve's gone. All he can think about is a drink.
Oh, Lord,
that's the only time I feel safe with him. When he's drunk. And not always then. The way he's been carrying on lately, Lord knows what he'll say or do next. I'll have to watch him every minute of the time. He's a fool.
Through thy mercy, O our Lord, who livest and reignest with the Father and the Holy Ghost, ever one God, world without end. Amen.
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 Goodbye, Uncle Edward. They're throwing dirt on your coffin now. But you won't mind. You're cold and silent now. Very different from the way you were 3 nights ago.
3 nights ago. Was that all it was? Another lifetime, but... Yes, that's right. Driving up to his house in the dark. Letting ourselves in. Uncle Edward!
He must be up in his study.
I guess so. Servant's night out. Uncle Edward!
The door above opened, and Uncle Edward started down the marble staircase. In my mind's eye, instead of Uncle Edward, I could see my friends, a whole crowd filling the room, and myself in a gorgeous gown descending to greet them. A much more fitting picture than the stodgy form of Uncle Edward as he came down toward us.
Well, this is a surprise.
I thought we'd drop in, Uncle Edward. It's been a long time.
6 weeks, to be exact, Fred. How are you, Grace?
Wonderful, thanks, Uncle Edward.
I'm glad to hear it. You look a little off your feed. Come on into the library. You'll be more comfortable here. Drink, Fred.
Why?
Don't be polite. From what I hear, you're rarely seen without one these days.
You sound as if you'd had spies watching us, Uncle Edward.
It's entirely possible.
What?
I've certainly been interested in your activities. For instance, I hear you can be found at a gambling house almost every evening, Grace.
Oh, only the fashionable ones, where everybody goes. You've got to keep in the swim nowadays.
If you can afford it. You can't. Not on Fred's salary.
That's the trouble.
Well, frankly, Uncle Edward, that's why we've come here tonight. We're in a jam again.
Money?
What else?
And you want me to bail you out, huh? Well, I'll be equally frank with you. This time, I'm not going to do it.
Well, just this
but Uncle,
I'm sorry I've helped you out of messes often enough in the past. Each time, I hoped you'd pull yourself together, settle down, and lead solid, respectable lives. But each time, you disappointed me. Now, I've given up hoping.
Uncle Edward, I promise you...
Too late, Fred. I can't believe your promises anymore. I've given you and Grace every chance. Now, I am washing my hands of you. You can't expect help from me ever again. Now or in the future.
Exactly what does that mean?
My lawyer's coming here tomorrow. And I'm going to cut Fred out of my will. Cut him out entirely.
Uncle Edward.
Every cent I have is to be left to charity.
Why, you're not serious. You can't be. Well, it's not fair. I'm your only nephew and
There's no use talking, Fred. My mind is made up. Now, would you care to discuss the weather?
No.
I thought you wouldn't, Grace.
Come along, Fred. Uncle Edward. I advise you to change your mind about this.
I beg your pardon?
Because if you don't, you may live to be sorry.
We went outside. Grace was in a white rage, and I was all jumping myself. We walked around the garden paths, trying to get hold of ourselves before we started back to town.
You know what this means, don't you, Fred? The end of everything. We'll never be able to get credit once it's known that Uncle Edward's cut us off.
Yes, I know.
Somehow... Some way. We've got to stop him from changing his will.
But how? You know there's no use arguing with him. He's as stubborn as a mule. Besides, there's no time left. He's going to do it tomorrow.
I know. Unless, of course, something happens to him before that.
Such as?
He could die.
What?
Suddenly.
Some chance he's as healthy. Grace, what are you thinking of?
You know.
You're mad.
If you want to spend the rest of your life struggling with debts, not able to do anything, I don't.
But...
Everything's perfect for it. The old man's alone in the house. No one knows we call this evening. No one
Stop
will.
Stop it. I won't listen to you.
Be a man for once in your life. Everything you want. Money, luxury. For 5 minutes' work.
Yes, but how?
The gun. The gun he keeps in the desk in his study. You've seen it.
Yes.
We'll take the money, valuables, to make it look like a robbery. Well? What are you afraid of? The sight of a little blood?
Grace, I don't know you when you talk like this.
I know what I'm after for both of us. It's our only chance of a future. Together. Are you coming?
Hi. Yes.
All right. Then let's go in. The servants will be coming back. We haven't any time to waste.
We went back into the house, climbed the long staircase to Uncle Edward's study. My mouth was dry, my knees were shaking. We reached the landing.
Knock on the door.
Grace, suppose
it. It's too late to suppose anything. Knock.
Yes?
Come in. I was expecting you back.
You were?
Certainly. I didn't think you let the money go that easily. Not after Grace's threat.
What do you mean?
You should have been a man, Grace. You've a completely ruthless streak in you. You'll stop at nothing to get what you're after. No wonder you've led poor Fred around by the nose so long.
Now, look here, Uncle Edward.
Sorry to hurt your feelings, Fred, but you must admit it's true. Now, if you two will explain why you came back...
We hope to make you change your mind.
You should know me better than that. I've said my last word.
Not your last, Uncle Edward. Not yet.
What Grace means
you
is...
You don't have to explain, Fred. Her interest in my desk explains itself. The right-hand drawer, Grace. Were you by any chance looking for this?
The gun.
Yes, I took the precaution of removing it. As I said, I was expecting you back.
I don't know what you're talking about, Uncle Edward. I was only looking for your checkbook. I thought the least that you could do was to help us out of our present difficulties.
It's a good story, Grace, but not quite good enough. Now, as it's almost 12, perhaps you'd both be good enough to leave my house permanently.
Well, you win, Uncle Edward. I suppose we were foolish to think that we could find a soft spot in that stone heart of yours.
You were foolish, all right. This way.
This reminds me of the old days, when Fred and I were first married, when we used to come and visit you. You used to see us to the head of the stairs when it came time to go. Just like this.
That was a long time ago.
I wish those days could come back.
Impossible. Well, good night, Fred, and goodbye.
Well, aren't you going to shake hands with your only nephew?
Well, since it's for the last time, goodbye, Fred.
Hold him, Fred. He's on, Fred.
What? Let go of me,
no,
Grace.
No, Fred. Get him. What?
No, stop. I'll give you money. All the money you want.
No, Fred. No.
You monsters. I'll make you pay for this. Stop.
Grace, what did we do? What did you make?
Get down there, quick.
There's no pulse. His heart. He's dead. Grace, when they find him...
An accident. The old man tripped on the stairs and broke his back. The money's ours, Fred. Everything we wanted.
What? What's that? What? Grace,
you fools. So you think it's yours, do you? Nothing is yours but death. Because you're going to pay. Pay.
Lying at the foot of the stairs, and a white-faced couple staring at each other. Did they hear a voice from beyond? Is it possible for the dead to make the living pay for...
Murder at Midnight.
Now, here is Grace Tilton to continue our story.
It went according to plan. The inquest raised no ugly questions or suspicions. And then after Uncle Edward's funeral, we settled down in the great old mansion. I could have been happy. So happy. Except for Fred. He'd taken to drinking again. Haven't you had enough, Fred?
Another little drink won't do me.
You're such an idiot. The way you've been acting ever since...
We did in poor Uncle Edward? Don't be afraid to say it, Grace. We're alone now.
Why did you give up your job so suddenly?
I'm a rich man now. No need to work.
But it looks so suspicious. And the way you've let yourself slip. That dirty shirt. You haven't shaved in 2 days.
Don't tell me you're ashamed of it.
I can't ask anyone to the house. And I had such plans for us. Entertaining, parties, making a name for ourselves.
Sorry, that's not my idea of a career.
In heaven's name, what is?
Drinks. More drinks. Then another one.
I won't let you turn into a drunken bum. I won't be disgraced like that.
I'll do exactly what I like, and you won't stop me. Don't forget, my love. We share a little secret together.
I'm not forgetting.
No matter what happens, you're tied to me for the rest of your life.
I wouldn't be too sure of that, Fred. If I get a chance at what I want, you won't stand in my way. Nothing will.
What did she mean by that? I thought about it, brooded over it, couldn't forget it. Then one evening as we sat together in a nightclub, things became clearer.
Did you hear me, Fred?
What?
I said I wanted a cigarette.
Oh, certainly, madam. Here you are. Match?
If you can hold it steady enough. Why do you have to get soused every time we go out?
A tribute to your intoxicating charm.
Oh, don't be so... Oh, why, there's Ronnie.
Good old Ronnie. Dowager's delight.
No, if you'll only look over this way.
With that dress you're wearing? You will.
Ronnie! Oh, Ronnie!
The change that came over her. Smile. Sparkling eyes as he came over to our table.
Well, hello there. This is a pleasant surprise, bumping into you again, Tilson.
Getting to be a regular routine. The theater, the races, everywhere I go with Grace.
Yes, we seem to share a lot in common, Fred.
Sit down, Ronnie. What do you have to drink?
Oh, nothing, thanks. I've had my quota for the evening.
Well, I'm glad someone knows when to stop.
Maybe Ronnie's got other vices.
I have, Fred. One of them's dancing. Do you mind if I take Grace out on the floor for a turn?
Why ask me? I'm sure Grace will agree to anything you say.
Fred, now what kind of a nasty...
Oh, come on, Grace. Fred didn't mean anything. Well, see you later, old boy.
They danced well together. As I watched them, I remembered the things I'd heard about Ronnie. Of his rich wife who died so conveniently. The fortune he'd run through. I saw Grace look into his eyes. Her lips moved. The suspicion grew on me till it became a certainty. They were plotting my death. The veins stood out in my forehead. My hands grew cold. But I knew exactly what I had to do. I had to strike first. I had to kill them before they killed me. If only I knew what they were plotting. If only I could hear they were whispering to each other.
Grace, darling, you're so silent.
It's Fred. How dare he act that way?
Well, he's a very unpleasant person.
Of course, he's under the weather, but that's no excuse.
Just means he doesn't give a rap for you. Never has.
Well, don't let's talk about him.
Right. Music's lovely.
Yes.
So are you.
Ronnie.
You dance like an angel. I could hold you in my arms forever. Oh, we're just made for each other. You know that, Grace. Don't you?
I'd rather not think about it.
But you must. Have you considered what we talked about the other day?
It's impossible.
Why? I love you more than anything in the world. We have the same tastes and ambitions. We could be a wonderful success together.
But...
You love me too, don't you?
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, then what's stopping us? What's so precious about the life of a drunken bum?
Fred's my husband.
Husband? You love him? Even respect him?
No. I did feel sorry for him. But not anymore. Not after tonight. I hate him.
That's more like it. Well, then there's nothing to interfere.
Except...
The danger? Leave that in my hands. You have just one job to do, Grace.
And that?
Get Fred up to my place in the mountains for a vacation. I guarantee he'll never come back.
I don't know if I should have been suspicious. Fred agreed to go up to Ronnie's place with surprising ease. It was almost as if he'd been expecting the invitation. The night we planned to do it, we sat in the living room, just the three of us. Ronnie was playing the piano.
I'm afraid I'm awfully rusty. I haven't practiced in weeks.
It sounds grand to me, Ronnie.
Why don't you join him, Grace? I know you're just dying to play with Ronnie. Duet, I mean.
Well, that's all we have time for anyway. I promised the Pearsons we wouldn't be late.
Oh, that beach picnic. Tell you the truth, I don't feel much like it.
But you promised to go, Fred.
Do you, world of good, old boy. Wonderful night for a swim.
You both seem very anxious to get me down to that lake.
Why, not at all. If you want Grace and me to go alone.
All right, I'll come. But I've got to go upstairs for my bathing suit. Wait for me here.
Well, hurry it up, old boy.
All set, Grace? You know exactly what to do?
I think so.
You make a great fuss about Fred drinking. That'll be remembered afterwards. I'll take care of him at the raft. Push his head underwater
and... He'll struggle. He'll call out.
Not in the condition he's in. He's as weak as a baby. Be all over in a few minutes. I'll swim back.
Ronnie!
Yes?
Isn't there some other way? We love each other so much. Can't we just...
Run off together? Let's be realistic, darling. We need the money. His money. Love in a cottage isn't our style.
I suppose not. Where is he? What's keeping him so long?
I'm just as glad. Come on, Grace. I want to make sure there's an extra bottle of whiskey for him in the car. This way, darling. Through here, into the garage.
Give me a hand, Ronnie.
Now, darling, everything's going to be all right.
Just being with you. Ronnie.
Yes?
I saw something moving.
Where?
Over there. Behind the car.
A Fred!
Hello. Thought I'd hurry things up by coming straight out to the garage.
Well, you gave us quite a start.
Why, Grace, something on your conscience?
Well, the Pearsons will be on our necks if we don't get started soon. Well, in you go. We're off to the races.
But just try to pick the winner. We drove out to the road, the winding road that led down to the valley. I knew just the spot where I had to leave them. From there on, their only companion would be the man with a sickle. Slow down, Ronnie.
Huh?
I'm not going to the picnic after all. My head's splitting.
But it's too late to drive you back, Fred.
You won't have to. I'll walk. Just let me on.
Very well.
But, Ronnie...
It's all right, Grace. We don't want Fred to have a miserable time at the picnic when we can settle things so much better this way.
Oh, thanks. I hate to run out on you, but... I've got my health to think of.
Oh, sure. Oh, incidentally, there's a shortcut back to the house through the fence there.
I don't see it.
Go on ahead. I'll turn the headlights on it.
Oh, thanks. Well, so long. Have a good trip. Where are you going?
Fred, look out!
Shut up!
Ronnie, you ran him down. You killed him.
It's what we wanted, isn't it?
Here on the road.
It'll look like a hit-and-run accident. We'll double back at the bottom of the hill and pretend we came from another direction.
Oh, we won't get away with it, Ronnie. It's no use. They'll catch us this time.
Snap out of it, Grace. Sorry, but you've got to get hold of yourself.
Yes, I must. I can't go to pieces. My hands are trembling. Where are you going?
Take the wheel. You're going to drive.
No, I'm scared.
Now move over. Go on.
No.
Now drive. Your life depends on it. Both our lives.
I started down that steep zigzag road, and slowly, my nerves relaxed. As the car swooped around the curves, I felt a strange acceleration.
Easy on these curves, Grace. It's a sheer drop if we go over the cliff.
Are you scared now, Ronnie?
Well, I want to keep my neck in one piece.
You needn't worry. I'm a good driver. Fred always...
What's the matter?
Nothing.
Keep your mind on the road. There's a hairpin bend ahead of here that...
Hey, look out!
Okay, I see it. I pushed on the brake. The pedal went all the way to the floor, but nothing caught. Nothing.
No, Grace. Now, do you know what I was doing there in the garage? I disconnected the brakes.
He did it! Fred!
The fence, Grace. The fence.
He connected them!
Yes, Grace. I meant to kill you with Ronnie.
Grace, slow down.
Oh, Ronnie, for heaven's sake, no time!
Slow down. Grace, coming after you. It's too late now. Long drop to the rocks. See you soon, Grace. You see
shattered wreckage of the car at the foot of the cliff. Three people, lonely no longer, as the clock strikes 12 for
murder at midnight.
Remember to be with us again when death plays host and the clocks strike 12 for
murder at midnight.
The part of Grace was played by Helen Shields. Wendell Holmes was her husband. Carl Emery, her lover. With music by Charles Paul, Murder at Midnight was directed by Anton M. Leder.
Murder at Midnight was as much a crossover supernatural thriller crime drama and is very reminiscent of competing series such as The Strange Dr. Weird, Quiet Please, The Inner Sanctum, and, of course, Lights Out. According to an article of Billboard magazine, talent and production costs for Murder at Midnight averaged $5,000 per program, which was really quite high for a radio series of the time. Murder at Midnight originally ran on the ABC network, but within a couple of years had crossed over to the Mutual network and several independent stations. ABC began life as the Blue Network, which was formed as a result of the breakup of NBC's Red and Blue networks in 1942. You see, what happened there was that the FCC felt that RCA, owner of the National Broadcasting Company, and therefore the National Broadcast Red, Blue, White, and Orange networks, was monopolistic in nature. So after losing a few years' worth of court cases, including one before the Supreme Court, and a handful of movements and machinations on the part of NBC, NBC divested themselves of the Blue Network, which was purchased for $8 million by conservative businessman Edward J. Noble, who got his fortune from a couple of sources. One being that he was the owner of the Rexall drug chain. The other, though, and more significantly, the creator of Life Savers Candies. So, after existing for a couple of years as just the Blue Network, the name was changed to the American Broadcasting Company in 1946. ABC originally relied on a great number of transcribed syndicating programming packages to fill out its broadcast day, particularly contributions from a handful of key stations, among which were KGO in San Francisco, KECA in Los Angeles, WENR in Chicago, WXYZ in Detroit, and WJZ in New York. Well, this brings us to our first break. Hey, I'm sorry, but I gotta do it. Look, I'm just gonna play some music, okay? just a minute or so ago, I mentioned Lights Out in passing. I thought that that might make a good segue into an episode of Lights Out. This is one of Arch Obler's, which aired on March the 17th of 1937. Arch Obler had a way of writing these fairly intense psychological drama that had very few voices in them, sometimes just one. In this case, it's more than one, but mostly it's told from the point of view of a fairly ordinary man by the name of Samuel Jones, whose one claim to significance in his life was his extraordinary profession as the state executioner.
Let's go back tonight to another time, the time of King George III of England. But our story tonight is not of monarchy. It's the story of an ordinary man by the name of Samuel Jones, who had the extraordinary profession of state executioner.
Tonight's Lights Out presents another psychological drama, a play in which the principal part is taken not by the character himself, but by his thoughts. The voice you are about to hear is that of the thoughts of one Samuel Jones, the state executioner for His Majesty George III. He sits alone in a dismal room, and these are his thoughts.
I want to be dead, dead, dead. Do you feel anything when you're dead? Are you hungry? Are you cold? Are you tired when you're dead? No. When I'm dead, I have peace, peace. I've got to have peace, kill myself. Yes, bullet in my heart. The pain. I don't like pain, but it can't hurt. They say it doesn't hurt, only hanging hurts. I know it does. I've seen their faces when they cut them down, purple, black. I've seen their faces when the masks came off and there's pain in them, pain that twists their faces, grinds their teeth, and gives them living hell until at last they die. That's why I've got to use this pistol to kill myself. I can't stand pain. All I want is peace. Peace. It's getting late. I've got to do it quick before they get here. I'll land much faster than they did, but they'll get here quick enough. I've got to be dead when they come in through that door. They can't bother the dead in their grave. I'll be dead, dead, deep, deep in the grave. Why should they blame me? I only did my duty. Someone's got to be the hangman. Someone's got... That's what he said to me that night. That's what his lordship said to me 20 years ago, it was. He said...
Samuel Jones, eh?
Yes, your lordship.
What makes you think you can do this work?
Oh, I just know, your worship. I know all about hanging, sir. Everything there is to know.
Well.
Hemp rope's best, sir. Hemp rope. But each rope's got to be fresh and new for every job. And you've got to keep it soapstoned and always in a cool, dry place.
Well, you do know something about it.
Oh, yes, sir. Then there's the short drop and the long drop. The long drop's better, sir. I know it is.
Eh?
It breaks their neck, sir. Every time it breaks their neck.
All right. I'll give you your chance. We're having a hanging here tomorrow. I'll let you do it. If all goes well, I'll recommend you to the prison board. If all goes well.
All did go well. Why not? And there I was, executioner for His Majesty. 5 guineas, a broken neck. 777 hangings in 20 years. 777 broken necks, and mine the hand that's rung the trap 777 times. And now the hand's got a pistol in it. When they reach here, when they knock on that door, I'll press the trigger, and so I won't have them face them. None of them. 777 broken necks, and no one knew that I was the man who did it. Not even she knew it. Ellen, my own wife, not even she. I met her, married her, and she didn't know. Until that day. Infernal day, that meddling fool nosing around.
It's the truth. I'm telling you, Mrs. Jones, it's God's bit judge.
Oh, no, no, there must be some mistake.
No mistake at all, Mrs. Jones. No mistake at all, my husband tells me. And he never makes mistakes, not my husband.
What did you say?
State executioner. You know your husband's... Oh, don't you know?
Please, I don't know what you're talking about.
Look here, don't you know what your husband does?
You mean the business he's in?
Business? Aye, hanging's the business.
Hanging?
Hanging, on a rope.
But what has Samuel to do with those?
Mrs. Jones, are you saying you don't know that Samuel's the hangsman?
You must be crazy.
Oh, so I'm crazy, am I? Well, he's the hangsman, and no mistake about it.
He's not.
And I tell
you... He's not. Get out of here. Get out, get out.
Well, now, you don't have to be... Well, here he is. Ask him yourself.
Oh, Sam.
What's going on here? What's the matter? What is it, Ellen?
Oh, Sam, this woman.
What about this woman? What?
All I've done is to tell the hard truth.
Oh, Sam, she says...
Says what? What?
All I said was that you were the hangsman, as you are.
Get out of here.
Now, just a minute.
Get out.
All right, I'll go.
Say one more word about me and I'll kill you. You hear me? I'll kill you. Meddling fools.
Sam.
You shouldn't have talked to her. Why did you listen?
Sam.
Things like that, it isn't good for me.
Sam, it is true.
Man's got to earn his living.
A living from killing?
You're crazy. I don't kill. I don't condemn them.
You killed them.
I tell you, I'm not the judge. Oh, now, Ellen.
Don't touch me, hangman.
All right, that's what I am, hangman.
Hangman.
Yes, hangman. Say it again and again. What do I care? I like being a hangman. You hear me? I like being a hangman.
Oh, no.
Yes,
no.
Get something more.
No, Sam.
I like killing them.
No.
I like the way they stumble when they walk up the stairs.
No.
I like the cold whiteness of their skins when I put the noose around their necks. I like the way everyone looks at me, watches me, and then the crash of the rope stretches. Sometimes their legs kick in the air and you hear them heaving for a little air. They can't get past the tight rope around their necks.
No, Sam. No, Sam. No, Sam.
When I was a boy, they strung a man up from a tree just outside of the town. And I watched him and I saw him dance on air. And I said to myself, someday I'll do that too.
No.
Hang them, legal, make them dance on air because it's the law. And now I'm doing what I wanted. Executioner for the crown. And Waylon won't change it a bit. Now, come here to me.
No, stay away from me.
Come here.
No, I won't stay with you. I won't, Hangman. I won't stay with you. I'll go away.
I thought she wouldn't leave me, but she did. Ellen left me. I looked all over, couldn't find her. After a while, I didn't care. What's a woman? I had my work. Hanging work. 5 guineas a hanging and gold coin. 5 of them. 5 golden guineas. I like the sound of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I bought a strong box and kept them there. Every hanging meant 5 more. Paying me, they were for what I liked to do. It was funny, very funny. I didn't miss her. No, why should I? I had my work. I got to be good at my work. The courts were good, too. They gave me plenty to do. I tried out different ways. I made a hanging machine with springs and sandbags that jerked the man into the air first and then dropped him through a trap. I tried out different ropes and different running nooses. Oh, I got to be good at it in 20 years, real good. Ticking, stop ticking. I hear you, blasted clock. I hear you. What are you trying to tell me? I know. There isn't much time left. They'll be here soon. Let them come. I'm ready. Pistol in my hand, I'm ready. After the first knock on the door, I won't be here to hear them. I'll have peace and quiet. Whatever they say to me, I won't hear it because I'll be dead. And why should they say it? What's done is done. 777 of them. It was fun because each died different. 777 different hangings. It was fun, I tell you, fun. Some are moaning. And some went to the gallows of crying. The best of all, I like the one that went out crazy scared.
Oh, no.
Green, yellow, wave. Yes. The ones that were crazy scared were the best. I like them fine. And 5 guineas just the same for having fun. 5 guineas. Up there at the door, I heard a sound. No. I just imagine no one's knocking. If they knock, I press the trigger. They won't get me, not me. 777 at 5 guineas each. Coins that bit into my flesh when I grabbed them tight. Oh, I like the sound. Money, yellow money. First, I like the hangings best, and then the money. Then I got to like them both. Watching. eager around the courtrooms, this trial, that trial. Would they hang him? Would they hang her? Would the judge say guilty? If he did, meant hanging another 5 guineas. Well, I watch for business, new business, my business. Hang them up and watch them die. When will they knock on the door, when? Pistol's heavy in my hand. He used a pistol, too, they said, Tom Allen. I read about him in the court announcement one day when I was outside of the courtroom looking for new business. Hanging business.
Thomas Allen, 20-year-old law student, was charged by the city police with having murdered his sweetheart, Lorraine Hamilton, 19-year-old daughter of Arvin Hamilton. Young Allen denied the charge vigorously. He stated that the girl had sent him a letter in which he told of her intentions of committing suicide. But at a late hour, Allen was unable to produce this letter. He was held without bond at the tower in the church.
Yes, that's what it said. That's what it said. He'd murdered her, young girl. The minute I read it, I said to myself, Sam Jones is the next one. I could hear the money clinking in my hand already. And Tom Allen hanging by his neck. What am I thinking about? What am I... Why don't they come and knock on the door and let me get this over with? I need the knocking on the door to give me nerve enough to press the trigger. This waiting, waiting... I waited for Tom Allen, too. I waited for them to say guilty to him so I could put the running noose around his neck. I waited, waited, going every day to the trial. The prosecutor for the Crown said...
Guilty.
The young man's solicitor said...
Not guilty.
The young man said...
I didn't do it, I tell you, I didn't do it. She did it herself. She wrote me a letter saying that she was killing herself. She wrote me a letter. She wrote me a letter, I tell you. She wrote me a letter.
Yes, that's what he said. She wrote me a letter saying she was killing herself. Where was the letter? Where was the letter? Nobody knew. Couldn't find it. And day after day, sitting there in the courtroom, I could see the noose coming close and close. A few days more and he'd be dancing on air. Another 5 guineas in my box. Such a pity. Such a handsome young man. Strong young neck for my rope. I say he didn't have a chance. What good did it do for his solicitor to keep saying...
I tell you, gentlemen... It is circumstantial evidence and circumstantial evidence alone which has been produced. A weird combination of circumstances have conspired to make it appear that the suicide of this unfortunate girl was a murder committed by this equally unfortunate young man. And an equally weird set of circumstances have resulted in the disappearance of this vital letter which clears Tom Allen of all responsibility for Mistress Hamilton's death. In this letter, the girl clearly stated that she was taking her own life by poison. In spite of the absence of this letter, surely you, as intelligent men, can tell after seeing and hearing Tom Allen's testimony that he is telling the truth, that such a letter did reach him, and that he is innocent of all wrongdoing.
But there was no letter. He didn't have a chance. The prosecutor for the Crown got up. He said...
A letter. A mysterious letter. And where, gentlemen of the jury, is this letter? To what mystical realms has it disappeared? This wondrous communication which so conveniently absolved Tom Allen for the death of that poor girl. Where, I ask again, is this letter? The young man has stated repeatedly that the letter was in his lodging undestroyed. But every inch of that lodging has been carefully examined. And yet, the letter has not been found. And why hasn't it been found, gentlemen? I'll tell you. It is because that letter does not exist. Lorraine Hamilton never wrote such a letter. She was murdered. Murdered in a fit of jealous rage by this man who expects you to believe a preposterous story about her death.
Yes. I sat there and I felt good. Because I saw that young fellow didn't have a chance. My noose was getting closer, closer to his neck. And then the black cap on the judge's head.
For this vicious crime against the order and security of the Crown, you, Thomas Allen, are hereby condemned to be hanged by the neck until dead.
No! No, I didn't do it. I didn't do it, I tell you. I didn't. I'm innocent. I didn't do it, I tell you. I didn't.
Then I had him. All his yelling, all his screaming wouldn't do any good. I had him. All ready for my noose. Guilty. I wanted to go up and thank the judges. Gave me business, hanging business, devil's business. Why don't they hurry up and get here? wouldn't have to think anymore. Knock on the door, I wouldn't have to think. Finger squeeze the trigger, finished piece. I won't have to think. I wouldn't have to think what happened then, what happened after they said the boy was guilty. They put him in a cell, death cell, the door shut tight. And I stood and watched. They put him in a cell. 5 golden guineas in a cell. A few more weeks and he'd be mine to teach that dancing lesson on thin air. I counted every day until they'd give him to me. I peeked along the corridor watching his cell. The warden of the prison said,
"Well, Sam, it certainly looks as if you're going to have another customer. I suppose you heard about it. The king refused young Allen's last appeal. He hangs in 2 more days. We'll try to make his going as easy as we can. I like the lad. Too bad about that letter, he says the girl wrote him. Well, no use talking about it. We've got to do our duty. Oh, by the way, you're going past the cell? Here. Here's some books of his. His landlady sent him. But he might like to read them while he had the time. Take them with you, Sam, and give them to him. It'll be his last time to read.
So I took the books along. Why not? Why not? Reading wouldn't save that neck. I started down the corridors with his books. Down the corridors toward the death cell. Something white fell out of one of his books, and I picked it up. It was a letter, and it read,
"Dear Tom, I told you I was going to kill myself, and now I'm going to do it. By the time you get this, the police ought to be accusing you of murder, since undoubtedly all those people who heard us quarrel the other night will be testifying that you killed me. That's the main reason I'm sending you this letter, so that you will have some proof that the poison they'll find in me was self-administered. Forgive me. I'm just tired of living."
And it was her name signed to it, hers, that girl's. The one they said he'd killed. This was the letter. The letter he'd been yelling about. The letter he wanted to save his neck. But his neck belonged to me already. 5 guineas. I stuck the letter deeper in my pocket and just waited until the night. The warden.
"Well, Sam, it looks as if we're going to have to go through with it. Now, I want everything done properly and no mistake. Going to have a large visitor's gallery. Very distinguished people. Say, and that reminds me, there's been some woman trying to see you all day. Some woman. Don't know who she is, Sam. She says she's got to see you."
Well, I wasn't seeing any woman, not that night. There was my work to do. See that everything was ready. The rope was ready. Everything perfect for a perfect hanging. It grew later and later. I could hear him in the death cell pleading with the minister.
"You've got to help me, sir. You've got to. You've got to get the king. He's got to believe that I didn't kill her. I didn't. Oh, won't anyone believe me? She wrote me a letter. She wrote me a letter in which she said she killed herself. She wrote me a letter, I tell you. She wrote me a letter."
Yes, a letter. The letter was in my pocket, and there it was going to stay until it was all over. He couldn't live. He couldn't live now. I'd waited too long. It had been such a long time since they'd given me a good, strong neck to hang. They couldn't cheat me now. At last, it was the hour. They came for him in his cell. They led him down the corridor. And then they were marching him up the stairs to the gallows. His lips moved. He said,
"I tell you, I didn't do it. The letter. The letter."
Black hood over his head.
"The letter, I didn't kill her. The letter, I tell you, I didn't do it."
His heart.
"This man is dead."
It was done. "This man is dead. 5 golden guineas, the warden said.
"Good work, Sam. Broke his neck."
I went out into the street. I was walking home. I felt real good. 5 golden guineas. A woman came up to me and said,
"Are you Sam Jones?"
"Yes, that's me. What do you want? I haven't got time."
"You'll have time to listen to me, hangman."
"Who are you?"
"Look at me."
"Ellen."
"Yes, Ellen.
Wife?
Wife no longer, hangman. Nor mother either.
Eh?
Nor mother either, and you're the thing that's done it.
Oh, wait, what?
I tried to reach you. I tried to tell you. They said you wouldn't see me. What could I do? What could I do? Your hand did it. Yours, hangman, yours.
What are you talking about, woman? Why?
Tonight, Tom Allen. My maiden name was Allen. Don't you understand? You hung Tom Allen.
Well, and so I did. What of it, woman? What of it?
Tom Allen, hangman, was your son.
No.
Son, your son, you hear me, hangman, your son, you hung your son, you hung your son, your son, you hung your son, your son, your son, you hung your
son. I began to run. Down the street, away from her, running. A man stepped out of the shadows, he stopped me, I couldn't see his face.
You killed my brother 7 years ago this night, hangman.
I said, no, leave me alone, leave me alone. I kept on running. A woman stopped me.
You killed my brother 7 years.
You hung my father, monster. You hung my father 11 years ago.
No, I said, no, let me go. I kept on running, but they kept after me, yelling, screaming. I kept on running, faster. New voices joined them. I looked back. The street was black with hundreds chasing me, yelling, screaming. I hung their son, father's brother. The street was black with them, I tell you, and every one of them akin to one of the 777 that had felt my rope. Chasing me. Hundreds of them yelling, screaming after my life, wanting my blood. Hands outstretched like claws to catch me, tear my flesh and stretch my eyes up. Running, let them catch me. No! That's the way I did it. Slammed the door, lost the pack of them. Every one of them, wives and sons and brothers of the 777. But they'll find me. They'll search me out. They're searching out. Yes, they'll find me. That's why my finger's on the pistol. The mob won't get me. No, the mob won't get me. Funny mob they were. They're not bodies, just heads of people chasing me and yelling. They won't get me. No, they won't. When they find me here, when they knock on that door, I'll kill myself. And they're here outside the door.
You won't get me. Not you. Yes, I hung your sons, husbands, killed your friends, lovers, but that's not all. I hung my son. You hear me? Hung my son for 5 guineas. Hung my son.
Yes. Come in. Come in, all of you, and see me die.
And you mean to say he yelled out for you to come in and then he shot himself?
Yes, sir. It's the ghost's truth. I knocked on the door. He yelled, come in. Come in, all of you, and see me die. And when I opened his door, bang, he did it.
And what were you banging on his door for this early in the morning? What were you after?
After nothing. I was looking for McDonald. This next house. I just knocked on the wrong door.
Wind and Fog, from 51 Tales by Lord Dunsany. Way for us, said the North Wind as he came down the sea on an errand of old winter. And he saw before him the gray, silent fog that lay along the tides. Way for us, said the North Wind, O ineffectual fog, for I am winter's leader in his age-old war with the ships. I overwhelm them suddenly in my strength, or drive upon them the huge seafaring bergs. I cross an ocean while you move a mile. There is mourning in inland places when I have met the ships. I drive them upon the rocks and feed the sea. Wherever I appear, they bow to our Lord the Winter. And to his arrogant boasting, nothing said the fog. Only he rose up slowly and trailed away from the sea, and crawling up long valleys, took refuge among the hills. And night came down, and everything was still, and the fog began to mumble in the stillness. And I hear him telling infamously to himself the tale of his horrible spoils. 150 galleons of old Spain, a certain argosy that went from Tyre, 8 fisher fleets and 90 ships of the line, 12 warships under sail with their carronades, 387 river craft, 42 merchantmen that carried spice, 30 yachts, 21 battleships of the modern time, 9,000 admirals. He mumbled and chuckled on, till I suddenly rose and fled from his fearful contamination. The end.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. Recording by Joy Chan. English Fairy Tales, collected by Joseph Jacobs. How Jack Went to Seek His Fortune. Once on a time there was a boy named Jack, and one morning he started to go and seek his fortune. He hadn't gone very far before he met a cat. "Where are you going, Jack?" said the cat. "I am going to seek my fortune." "May I go with you?" "Yes," said Jack. "The more the merrier." So on they went, jiggledy-jolt, jiggledy-jolt. They went a little further, and they met a dog. "Where are you going, Jack?" said the dog. "I am going to seek my fortune." "May I go with you?" "Yes," said Jack. "The more the merrier." So on they went, jiggledy-jolt, jiggledy-jolt. They went a little further, and they met a goat. "Where are you going, Jack?" said the goat. "I am going to seek my fortune." "May I go with you?" "Yes," said Jack. "The more the merrier." So on they went, jiggledy-jolt, jiggledy-jolt. They went a little further, and they met a bull. "Where are you going, Jack?" said the bull. "I am going to seek my fortune." "May I go with you?" "Yes," said Jack. "The more the merrier." So on they went, jiggledy-jolt, jiggledy-jolt. They went a little further, and they met a rooster. "Where are you going, Jack?" said the rooster. "I am going to seek my fortune." "May I go with you?" "Yes," said Jack. "The more the merrier." So on they went, jiggledy-jolt, jiggledy-jolt. Well, they went on till it was about dark, and they began to think of some place where they could spend the night. About this time, they came in sight of a house, and Jack told them to keep still while he went up and looked in through the window. And there were some robbers counting over the money. Then Jack went back and told them to wait till he gave the word, and then to make all the noise they could. So when they were all ready, Jack gave the word, and the cat mewed, and the dog barked, and the goat bleated, and the bull bellowed, and the rooster crowed, and altogether they made such a dreadful noise that it frightened the robbers all away. And then they went in and took possession of the house. Jack was afraid the robbers would come back in the night, and so when it came time to go to bed, he put the cat in the rocking chair, and he put the dog under the table, and he put the goat upstairs, and he put the bull down cellar, and the rooster flew up onto the roof, and Jack went to bed. By and by the robbers saw it was all dark, and they sent one man back to the house to look after their money. Before long he came back in a great fright and told them his story. "I went back to the house," said he, "and went in and tried to sit down in the rocking chair, and there was an old woman knitting, and she stuck her knitting needles into me." That was the cat, you know. "I went to the table to look after the money, and there was a shoemaker under the table, and he stuck his awl into me." That was the dog, you know. "I started to go upstairs, and there was a man up there threshing, and he knocked me down with his flail." That was the goat, you know. "I started to go down cellar, and there was a man down there chopping wood, and he knocked me up with his axe." That was the bull, you know. "But I shouldn't have minded all that if it hadn't been for that little fellow on top of the house who kept a-hollering, 'Chuck him up to me! Chuck him up to me!' Of course, that was the cock-a-doodle-doo."
Now, here's a likely customer, a housewife, if there ever was one. Excuse me, madam, would you like to try Gunge Margarine?
Oh, yes, don't mind if I do. Mmm.
And now, would you try Brand X?
Yes, please. Ugh.
Would you like to know what Brand X was?
I certainly would.
Well, it was pigeon droppings.
Alien Worlds was an American syndicated radio show that produced a total of 30 episodes in 1979, beginning on January the 7th. Of the 30 shows, however, only 26 were ever aired. This show had an excellent soundtrack and generally high production standards. The series would be quite successful, eventually playing on over 500 radio stations, and would be picked up and played with good success in New Zealand and Australia. The stories revolve around the International Space Authority. This is an authority established by all of the governments of Earth to promote space development and exploration. The main base, usually just called Starlab, has an official name, the Arthur C. Clarke Astronomical Observatory. What happens in this story is that ISA researchers go to a planet called Tremorlane, and they discover that strange things are happening there. Dreamy things.
Slowly orbiting at the edge of deep space, 1,000 kilometers beyond 21st century Earth, is the Arthur C. Clarke Astronomical Observatory, Starlab. Here, Starlab Research Director Maura Cassidy and scientists and technicians of the International Space Authority watch over the countless star systems that fill the universe. This week, Maura Cassidy and space exploration team captains John Graydon and Buddy Griff encounter the phantoms of Tamerlane and experience a dream within a dream on Alien Worlds.
Starlab Control. This is the Galileo. Do you read me?
This is Starlab. I read you, Galileo. What's your situation, Captain Egan? Where are you?
We're 200 kilometers out at Vector 205. And this isn't Captain Egan. It's Lieutenant Becker. Egan is dead.
Lieutenant Becker, this is Dr. Cassidy. What happened to Captain Egan?
He died in the maelstrom, Dr. Cassidy. A whirlpool in the universe. Captain Egan fell into it and drowned in the stars.
Well, he's either tripped out on something or he's in shock.
Lieutenant Becker, what's the condition of your crew?
Sleeping. They fell asleep on Tamerlane. They're still dreaming.
Call the short-range vehicle hangar, Jerry, and order a couple of tugs out to tow them in.
Right.
And all my days are trances, and all my nightly dreams are where thy dark eye glances, and where thy footstep gleams, in what ethereal trances.
Attention all SRV personnel. This is a priority rescue alert. Prepare three Magnum class tugs for immediate launch. Utility pilots Haskell, Shaw, and Henning, please report to the SRV operations officer.
Rear, Vector I. Roger, fireplane.
Mission Control, Galaxy 9.
Roger, Starlab. We have the Galileo in sight and she is damaged. Looks like the starboard thruster housing's ripped open and she's leaking fuel. Tug 17.
17, go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, Jimmy, see if you can check out that fuel leak, will you?
Roger.
Tug 9. Tug 9. Come on, Ron, I know you're there. I can hear you swearing at your receiver in my headphones.
Sorry about that, Lee. I had to switch to another channel. Your transmission was breaking up.
Okay. Get around to the Galileo's port side and see if you can get a grappler pad on her. Use the standard placement.
Roger. I have grappler contact, Lee. Pad magnetism stable. Okay, Lee, I've closed off the leak.
All right. Now let's get a grappler pad on her starboard side. I'll stick one on the nose.
Roger.
Okay, you guys, let's haul her in.
Five minutes after launch, Space Tugs 2, 9, and 17 returned to Starlab with a damaged laboratory ship in tow and guided into Docking Bay 14.
Report to Docking Bay 14 and stand by for incoming casualties.
30 minutes after the Galileo's arrival, Starlab's executive physician, Dr. Diana Rossiter, begins a computer-assisted examination of the ship's unconscious crew. Three hours later, Starlab's Mycroft computer completes its analysis of the examination.
Look at the waveform patterns here on screen 3. These are the electroencephalograms of the Galileo's crew. You notice anything unusual?
Looks like the same EEG repeated 10 times.
That's right. And not only are their EEGs identical, they all have the same pulse rate, temperature, respiration, and dream state iRhythms.
Really?
I don't know what happened to them, Maura. But they're all dreaming the same dream.
Alien Worlds will continue. Alien Worlds continues. 6 weeks after its disappearance during a routine mission, the deep space laboratory ship Galileo returns to Starlab, its captain missing and presumed dead, its first officer in a state of second-degree mind shock, its crew asleep and dreaming identical dreams.
What about Lieutenant Becker?
He talked off and on during his examination, but he was getting so anxious I thought it best to sedate him for a while.
Diana, did you record what he said during the examination?
Maddie's making a copy of the tape now. You want to hear it?
Mm-hmm. Have her send it up to my quarters. I'll listen to it when John and Buddy get here.
Solaris to Starlab Control.
This is Starlab. Go ahead, Solaris.
We've picked up some time, Jerry. Our revised ETA is 4 minutes, 13 seconds.
4 plus 13, Roger. Okay, John, your revised docking orbit insertion coordinates are 196 degrees at subvector 20 alpha, docking bay 9.
See you in a few minutes, Jerry. Solaris out.
Starlab clear on ITS channel 096.
You have that look on your face, buddy. What are you thinking?
Remember what Maura said about Lieutenant Becker? You know, that verse he quoted when she asked what happened to Frank?
Yeah, what about it?
Well, it's part of a poem by Thackeray or Tennyson, one of those guys. It's from that period, anyway. I know I've either heard it or read it. Wait a minute. Ingrid. Ingrid read it to me.
Solaris to Starlab Control.
This is Starlab. Stand by. Go ahead, Solaris.
Jerry, patch me through to the library. I have to talk to Ingrid.
Roger. Stand by.
And all my days are trances, and all my nightly dreams are where thy dark eye glances, and where thy footstep gleams, in what ethereal dances, by what eternal streams.
That's it. What's it from, Ingrid?
It's the last verse of a poem called To One in Paradise by Edgar Allan Poe. And that isn't Lieutenant Becker's only reference to Poe. Buddy, Play back the last part of Dr. Rossiter's tape again.
Okay.
They're almost finished, Lieutenant. Now, look into the light.
No, it was dark. It was always dark.
Mm-hmm.
Then Captain Hagen wanted to explore, so we went out in a crawler.
I see. Now, the other eye, Lieutenant.
The whirlpool started. I got scared, and I jumped out of the crawler, and it was swallowed up in the maelstrom. I didn't mean to leave him there.
I know you didn't, Lieutenant.
My hands. When I look at my hands, I see sand. Grains of golden sand. How few, yet how they creep through my fingers to the deep. While I weep. While I weep.
No, dear. Lie down, Lieutenant. Come, that's right. Now, I'm going to give you something to make you feel better.
Well, anyway, the whirlpool he mentioned coincides with one of Poe's short stories, A Descent into the Maelstrom.
And the reference to grains of golden sand?
A poem Poe wrote in 1847 after his wife died, A Dream Within a Dream.
Maura.
What is it, Jerry?
You better get up here. I have a transmission coming through on the Mayday frequency. It's Captain Egan.
Egan? What? How can that be?
We're on our way, Jerry.
Somewhere in the Ursa Minor system. The exact coordinates are on the Galileo's flight recorder.
What about the whirlpool, Captain?
An illusion, a dream. Like everything else around here.
What's your situation now, Frank?
Well, the batteries here in the crawler are about gone. So this will have to be my last transmission. And I have rations for 2, maybe 3 days. Get me out of here, buddy. I don't think I can...
Captain Egan? Captain Egan? Ah, that's it. We've lost him.
Ingrid, is Tamerlane connected to Poe?
It's one of his most famous poems.
What's it about?
Love, life, death, rebirth, the entire spectrum of physical and mystical experience.
Call Docking Bay 14, Jerry. Tell Simon to disconnect the Galileo's flight recorder and take it to the Solaris.
Okay.
Ingrid, go back to the library and pull everything you have on Edgar Allan Poe. Hard copy, sleep tapes, microcards, everything. Then meet us at the Solaris.
Am I going with you?
You certainly are.
But why?
Because what happened to the Galileo might happen to us. And since this whole incident is somehow connected to Poe, what you know about his work might be our only protection. Okay, let's get busy.
13:30 hours, 40 minutes after receiving Captain Egan's transmission, Maura and Ingrid enter Docking Bay 9 and join John and Buddy aboard the Solaris.
Is everything programmed and ready?
Oh, we're all set, Maura.
Good.
Better strap yourselves in. We're due to launch in 90 seconds. Ready?
Let's go.
Okay, Buddy, let's run it down. Exterior hatches and fuel bay doors. Pressurized and locked. Environmental control systems. Green across the board. ECS backup terminals. In phase and programmed for zero-time emergency interlock. Microwave antenna function. Positive. Digital auto guidance and inertial gyro integration. Auto guidance in phase. Gyro integration at 0-3 seconds. Tank pressure. Maximum, 1 through 6. Cancel the ignition safety terminal. Positive function on IST lockout.
Alien Worlds will continue. Continues. 48 hours after launching from Starlab, the Solaris penetrates the Ursa Minor star system, a constellation filled with glowing stellar dust and brilliant star clusters, a constellation dominated by the second magnitude binary star, Polaris. 3 hours later, guided by the navigation coordinates from the Galileo's flight recorder, the sleek white SET interceptor lands on the dark, mist-shrouded planetoid of Tamerlane.
Open the visual scanner ports, buddy. Let's have a look at this place.
Okay.
There's nothing but mist and shadows. Can you move a little to the right, buddy? I can't see the screen from back here.
Oh, yeah, sorry. How's that?
That's fine. It looks like the landscape in the fall of the House of Usher.
Wait a minute. What's that in the corner of the screen?
It's a cat.
Yeah.
A black cat. It's...
Wait a minute. What happened?
Where'd it go? It's gone. Was it really there? It's gone. Maybe it wasn't really there.
It had to be there.
Oh, buddy, I'm so sleepy.
We all saw it, didn't we?
Where's Frank? Oh, we have to find Frank.
Don't go to sleep. Don't go to sleep. We can't go to sleep. Don't go to sleep.
Tolling of the bells, iron bells. What a world of solemn thought their melody compels. Hear the loud alarm bells, brazen bells. What a tale of terror now their turbulency tells.
In there, Fortunato. The cask of Amontillado is in there.
For the love of God!
I forced the last stone into position and plastered it up. Against the new masonry, I re-erected the old rampart of bones. For half a century, no mortal has disturbed them.
Rest in peace, Fortunato. Requiescat in pace.
Under the floor. He's hidden the old man's body under the floor. Louder. Louder. Louder.
I admit it. Tear up the planks. Stop the beating of his hideous heart.
The vibration of the pendulum was at right angles to my length. It slowly descended, hissing back and forth, repeating its arc again and again.
As the shades of evening drew on, within view of the melancholy House of Usher.
And the raven, never flitting, still sitting. On the pallid bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of the demons that is dreaming.
How shall the burial rite be read? The solemn song be sung? The requiem for the loveliest dead that ever died so young?
All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream.
Dr. Cassidy.
Within a dream.
Buddy.
Within a dream.
John.
Within a dream.
Buddy. John, wake up. Dr. Cassidy, wake up.
Frank.
I saw you land about an hour ago. I've been trying to raise you on the crawler's short-range transmitter ever since.
Bells. I was dreaming about bells. And some kind of terrible razor swinging back and forth.
And there was a murder. An old man was killed. His body was under a floor, but his heart wouldn't stop beating.
The pit in the pendulum. The telltale heart. Poe,
We've all been dreaming about his stories and poems.
Everyone aboard the Galileo had the same dreams. After we landed here to repair the meteorite damage, we saw a black cat. When it ran into the mist, we all fell asleep.
But you weren't asleep the whole time you were here. What woke you up?
Earth tremors and storms. And after every disturbance, the mist would clear long enough for us to see another part of Tamerlane had disappeared. It's losing its molecular density, too. I've been checking it out on the crawler's densiometer. Tamerlane is returning to its own dimension.
What do you mean?
And Tamerlane isn't supposed to be in this time-space continuum. Somehow or other, it slipped out of its own dimension. And now, it's slipping back.
How do you know that?
The longer you stay here, the more you dream. And with every dream, you understand a little bit more about Tamerlane and what it is.
Have you found out why all the dreams are related to Edgar Allan Poe?
Yes, I have. I found the house last night.
House? What house?
The house where the dream chamber is. The House of Usher. Come on, I'll show you. Stairs, then turn left.
Ooh. It's freezing in here.
Help me with the door, John.
Impossible.
It's impossible.
It's not a room at all.
Space.
Oh, it's beautiful.
We're in space.
The Dream Chamber, an opening in the time-space continuum. A place enclosed not by walls, but by the golden light and phantom shadows of a parallel universe. A void filled with glittering star fields and an eternity of stellar mists, tinted with all the colors of creation. And in the center of the Dream Chamber, a bed made of interlocking beams of light. And lying on the bed, forever asleep and forever dreaming.
It's him. It's Poe.
Is he alive?
He's a dream, buddy. A dream sustained by everyone who reads his work and falls in love with its beauty and terror, its sorrow, its truth.
Are we looking at eternity?
Well, we're looking at Poe's eternity.
It's fading. Everything's fading.
Let's get back to the ship before we get caught in this.
Look, he's standing up.
Ingrid, what's wrong with you? He's not standing up. He's still...
afraid. He's running away.
Ingrid.
Buddy, help me. I can't hear anything.
Help me with her, Frank.
Okay, let's get her out of here.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Oh, by the way, I heard from Dr. Rossiter. Lieutenant Becker's all right, and so is the Galileo's crew. They woke up about a half an hour ago.
All right, Commissioner, thank you. See you tomorrow.
ISA Comm Center clear.
Half hour ago. That means they woke up the instant Tamerlane disappeared.
What are you doing, Ingrid?
The hallucination I had in the dream chamber... and that terrible stillness afterwards. I know it's related to one of Poe's stories. I remember something...
I remember.
Here it is. Silence. A fable. And mine eyes fell upon the countenance of the man. And he was afraid.
And he was afraid.
He raised his head and listened. But there was no voice throughout the vast, illimitable void. Only silence.
Only silence.
And the man turned his face away and fled into the distance.
And I beheld him no more.
Mm-hmm.
Dream Within a Dream was written by Ron Thompson and starred Linda Gary, Chuck Olson, Bruce Philip Miller, Corey Burton, and special guest stars Francis Bay, Clark Warren, Mel Wells, Jack Angel, and Marilyn Schreffler. Associate producer, Ron Thompson. Music director, Tom Rounds. Engineer, Stu Jacobs. Technical consultant, Peter Skye. Assistant to the producer, Jim Cook. Alien Worlds was created, produced, and directed by Lee Hansen. And so, until next week, this is Roger Dressler inviting you to join us from the elsewhere and elsewhen of Alien Worlds.
Did you notice that the computer was called Mycroft? A tip of the hat to Sherlock Holmes' even smarter brother, Mycroft Holmes. There are a couple other things I noticed. The name of the planet, Tamerlane, is the name of an epic poem by Edgar Allan Poe, which was published in 1826. The spaceship was called Solaris. Do you think it's a coincidence that there is a classic 1961 science fiction novel written by the Polish writer Stanisław Lem called Solaris? That could be a coincidence, I guess, but somehow I doubt it.
Strange Adventure.
Outside, the wind howled and piled the fine powdered snow and drifts around the little post office. Inside, Dan Arden sorted the few letters that had come that day to the mining village of Coquille Falls, Alaska. Halfway through the pile, he came across one for Saul Sherman. Old Saul received very little mail, but on the rare occasions when he did, dear old Dan would trudge up the long trail to the cabin on 10 Mile Creek to deliver it. Each time, Saul would present him with a big gold nugget. Dan finished his sorting and began to get ready for the trip. The Arctic winter was at its height, and it was deathly cold, but it held no fears for the letter carrier. The old sourdough had faced worse many times, and this was a trip that would pay. He fastened the thongs of his snowshoes and opened the door against the knife edge of the wind. It was worse than he had expected. A blizzard was making up, but the lure of that gold nugget was stronger than the force of the wind. So Dan made his way out of town and struck the trail to 10 Mile Creek. With every step, the velocity of the wind increased, and the air was filled with fine particles of snow that stung like shot. By now, Dan had gone too far to turn back. The trail had disappeared in the blizzard, and he had only his instinct to guide him. Still, he pushed on. Then, above the roar of the blizzard, came a new sound. At first, it was distant and faint. Then, it grew louder, and Dan knew that he had more than the storm to fear. The sound was a wolf pack in full cry. He pushed on, redoubling his efforts against the storm. There was no immediate danger, but he had brought no gun. And if he were forced by exhaustion to stop, the wolves might be hungry enough to close in and pull him down. The letter he had come so far to deliver was almost forgotten. His only thought now was to reach the cabin and safety. The wolves were closing in, and each step that Dan took was a separate and agonizing effort. He felt that he must stop and rest, but he knew that he couldn't. He struggled on. At that moment, when he knew that he could go no farther, something loomed up just in front of him. It was a cabin. With his last ounce of strength, he broke into a stumbling run. He beat upon the door and fell into the arms of Saul Sherman as it opened. Soon he was warm, and remembering what had brought him, he reached into his pocket for the letter.
This came for you this morning, Saul. Thought it must be important, so I hurried right up here with it.
Saul took the letter with a grin of pleasure.
That's so mighty nice of you, Dan.
Excitedly, he slit it open and took out the small booklet it contained. The important letter that Dan had almost given his life to deliver was a seed catalog Saul had ordered for its pretty pictures.
This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of
Strange Adventure.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock, 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock, 9, 13, 14, 17, or, just a minute, or to hell with it.
Ah, greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives, whether we want to or not.
Did you hear him? Listen to Creswell. He's right, you know. We are all going to live in the future. It may be the only thing he was ever right about. Unfortunately, the future's not what it used to be. Not that I prefer the past. The past is unchanging, immutable. The only thing that changes about the past is our opinion of it.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Trial for Murder by Charles Dickens. I have always noticed a prevalent want of courage, even among persons of superior intelligence and culture, as to imparting their own psychological experiences when those have been of a strange sort. Almost all men are afraid that what they could relate in such wise would find no parallel or response in a listener's internal life and might be suspected or laughed at. A truthful traveler who should have seen some extraordinary creature in the likeness of a sea serpent would have no fear of mentioning it, but the same traveler, having had some singular presentiment, impulse, vagary of thought, visions, so-called, dream, or other remarkable mental impression, would hesitate considerably before he would own to it. To this reticence I attribute much of the obscurity in which such subjects are involved. We do not habitually communicate our experiences of these subjective things as we do our experiences of objective creation. The consequence is that the general stock of experience in this regard appears exceptional, and really is so, in respect of being miserably imperfect. In what I am going to relate, I have no intention of setting up, opposing, or supporting any theory whatever. I know the history of the bookseller of Berlin. I have studied the case of the wife of a late astronomer royal, as related by Sir David Brewster, and I have followed the minutest details of a much more remarkable case of spectral illusion occurring within my private circle of friends. It may be necessary to state, as to this last, that the sufferer, a lady, was in no degree, however distant, related to me. A mistaken assumption on that head might suggest an explanation of a part of my own case, but only a part, which would be wholly without foundation. I cannot be referred to my inheritance of any developed peculiarity, nor had I ever before any at all similar experience, nor have I ever had any at all similar experience since. It does not signify how many years ago, or how few, a certain murder was committed in England, which attracted great attention. We hear more than enough of murderers as they rise in succession to their atrocious eminence, and I would bury the memory of this particular brute, if I could, as his body was buried in Newgate Jail. I purposely abstain from giving any direct clue to the criminal's individuality. When the murder was first discovered, no suspicion fell, or I ought to say, for I cannot be too precise in my facts, it was nowhere publicly hinted that any suspicion fell on the man who was afterwards brought to trial. As no reference was at that time made to him in the newspapers, it is obviously impossible that any description of him can at that time have been given in the newspapers. It is essential that this fact be remembered. Unfolding at breakfast my morning paper containing the account of that first discovery, I found it to be deeply interesting, and I read it with close attention. I read it twice, if not three times. The discovery had been made in a bedroom, and when I laid down the paper, I was aware of a flash, rush, flow, I do not know what to call it. No word I can find is satisfactorily descriptive, in which I seemed to see that bedroom passing through my room, like a picture impossibly painted on a running river. Though almost instantaneous in its passing, it was perfectly clear, so clear that I distinctly, and with a sense of relief, observed the absence of the dead body from the bed. It was in no romantic place that I had this curious sensation, but in chambers in Piccadilly, very near the corner of St. James Street. It was entirely new to me. I was in my easy chair at the moment, and the sensation was accompanied with a peculiar shiver which started the chair from its position, but it is to be noted that the chair ran easily on casters. I went to one of the windows, there are two in the room, and the room is on the second floor, to refresh my eyes with the moving objects down in Piccadilly. It was a bright autumn morning, and the street was sparkling and cheerful. The wind was high. As I looked out, it brought down from the park a quantity of fallen leaves, which a gust took and whirled into a spiral pillar. As the pillar fell and the leaves dispersed, I saw two men on the opposite side of the way, going from west to east. They were one behind the other. The foremost man often looked back over his shoulder. The second man followed him at a distance of some 30 paces, with his right hand menacingly raised. First, the singularity and steadiness of this threatening gesture in so public a thoroughfare attracted my attention, and next, the more remarkable circumstance that nobody heeded it. Both men threaded their way among the other passengers with a smoothness hardly consistent even with the action of walking on a pavement, and no single creature that I could see gave them place, touched them, or looked after them. In passing before my window, they both stared up at me. I saw their two faces very distinctly, and I knew that I could recognize them anywhere. Not that I had consciously noticed anything very remarkable in either face, except that the man who went first had an unusually lowering appearance, and that the face of the man who followed him was of the color of impure wax. I am a bachelor, and my valet and his wife constitute my whole establishment. My occupation is in a certain branch bank, and I wish that my duties as head of a department were as light as they are popularly supposed to be. They kept me in town that autumn when I stood in need of change. I was not ill, but I was not well. My reader is to make the most that can be reasonably made of my feeling jaded, having a depressing sense upon me of a monotonous life and being slightly dyspeptic. I am assured by my renowned doctor that my real state of health at that time justifies no stronger description, and I quote his own from his written answer to my request for it. As the circumstances of the murder gradually unraveling took stronger and stronger possession of the public mind, I kept them away from mine by knowing as little about them as was possible in the midst of the universal excitement. But I knew that a verdict of willful murder had been found against the suspected murderer, and that he had been committed to Newgate for trial. I also knew that his trial had been postponed over one sessions of the Central Criminal Court, on the ground of general prejudice and want of time for the preparation of the defense. I may further have known, but I believe I did not, when, or about when, the sessions to which his trial stood postponed would come on. My sitting room, bedroom, and dressing room are all on one floor. With the last, there is no communication but through the bedroom. True, there is a door in it, once communicating with the staircase, but a part of the fitting of my bath has been, and had been then for some years, fixed across it. At the same period, and as a part of the same arrangement, the door had been nailed up and canvased over. I was standing in my bedroom late one night, giving some directions to my servant before he went to bed. My face was towards the only available door of communication with the dressing room, and it was closed. My servant's back was towards that door. While I was speaking to him, I saw it open and a man look in, who very earnestly and mysteriously beckoned to me. The man was the man who had gone second from the two along Piccadilly, and whose face was of the color of impure wax. The figure, having beckoned, drew back and closed the door. With no longer pause than was made by my crossing the bedroom, I opened the dressing-room door and looked in. I had a lighted candle already in my hand. I felt no inward expectation of seeing the figure in the dressing-room, and I did not see it there. Conscious that my servant stood amazed, I turned round to him and said, "Derek, could you believe that in my cool senses I fancied I saw a—" As I there laid my hand upon his breast, with a sudden start he trembled violently and said, "Oh, Lord, yes, sir, a dead man beckoning." Now, I do not believe that this John Derrick, my trusty and attached servant for more than 20 years, had any impression whatever of having seen such a figure until I touched him. The change in him was so startling when I touched him that I fully believe he derived his impression in some occult manner from me at that instant. I bade John Derrick bring me some brandy, and I gave him a dram, and was glad to take one myself. Of what had preceded the night's phenomenon, I told him not a single word. Reflecting on it, I was absolutely certain that I had never seen that face before, except on the one occasion in Piccadilly. Comparing its expression when beckoning at the door with its expression when it had stared up at me as I stood at my window, I came to the conclusion that on the first occasion it had sought to fasten itself upon my memory, and on the second occasion it had made sure of being immediately remembered. I was not very comfortable that night, though I felt a certainty, difficult to explain, that the figure would not return. At daylight I fell into a heavy sleep, from which I was awakened by John Derrick's coming to my bedside with a paper in his hand. This paper, it appeared, had been the subject of an altercation at the door between its bearer and my servant. It was a summons to me to serve upon a jury at the forthcoming sessions of the Central Criminal Court at the Old Bailey. I had never before been summoned on such a jury, as John Derrick well knew. He believed, I am not certain at this hour whether with reason or otherwise, that that class of jurors were customarily chosen on a lower qualification than mine, and he had at first refused to accept the summons. The man who served it had taken the matter very coolly. He said that my attendance or non-attendance was nothing to him. There the summons was, and I should deal with it at my own peril and not at his. For a day or two I was undecided whether to respond to this call or take no notice of it. I was not conscious of the slightest mysterious bias, influence, or attention one way or another. Of that I am as strictly sure as of every other statement that I make here. Ultimately I decided, as a break in the monotony of my life, that I would go. The appointed morning was a raw morning in the month of November. There was a dense brown fog in Piccadilly, and it became positively black, and in the last degree oppressive, east of Temple Bar. I found the passages and staircases of the courthouse flaringly lighted with gas, and the court itself similarly illuminated. I think that until I was conducted by officers into the old court and saw its crowded state, I did not know that the murderer was to be tried that day. I think that until I was so helped into the old court with considerable difficulty, I did not know into which of the two courts sitting my summons would take me. But this must not be received as a positive assertion, for I am not completely satisfied in my mind on either point. I took my seat in the place appropriated to jurors in waiting, and I looked about the court as well as I could through the cloud of fog and breath that was heavy in it. I noticed the black vapor hanging like a murky curtain outside the great windows, and I noticed the stifled sound of wheels on straw or tan that was littered in the street. Also, the hum of the people gathered there, which a shrill whistle or a louder song or hail than the rest occasionally pierced. Soon afterwards, the judges, two in number, entered and took their seats. The buzz in the court was awfully hushed. The direction was given to put the murderer to the bar. He appeared there, and in that same instant I recognized in him the first of the two men who had gone down Piccadilly. If my name had been called then, I doubt if I could have answered to it audibly. But it was called about sixth or eighth in the panel, and I was by that time able to say, "Here." Now observe, as I stepped into the box, The prisoner, who had been looking on attentively, but with no sign of concern, became violently agitated and beckoned to his attorney. The prisoner's wish to challenge me was so manifest that it occasioned a pause, during which the attorney, with his hand upon the dock, whispered with his client and shook his head. I afterwards had it from that gentleman that the prisoner's first affrighted words to him were, "At all hazards, challenge that man!" But that as he could give no reason for it, and admitted that he had not even known my name until he heard it called and I appeared, it was not done. Both on the ground already explained, that I wished to avoid reviving an unwholesome memory of that murderer, and also because a detailed account of his long trial is by no means indispensable to my narrative, I shall confine myself closely to such incidents in the 10 days and nights during which we, the jury, were kept together, as directly bear on my own curious personal experience. It is to that, and not to a page of the Newgate Calendar, that I beg attention. I was chosen foreman of the jury. On the second morning of the trial, after evidence had been taken for 2 hours, I heard the church clock strike. Happening to cast my eyes over my brother jurymen, I found an inexplicable difficulty in counting them. I counted them several times, yet always with the same difficulty. In short, I made them one too many. I touched the brother juryman whose place was next me, and I whispered to him, "Oblige me by counting us." He looked surprised by the request, but turned his head and counted. "Why," says he suddenly, "we are but no, that is not possible. No, we are 12. According to my counting that day, we were always right in detail, but in the gross we were always one too many. There was no appearance, no figure to account for it, but I had an inward foreshadowing of the figure that was surely coming. The jury were housed at the London Tavern. We all slept in one large room on separate tables, and we were constantly in the charge and under the eye of the officer sworn to hold us in safe keeping. I see no reason for suppressing the real name of that officer. He was intelligent, highly polite and obliging, and, I was glad to hear, much respected in the city. He had an agreeable presence, good eyes, enviable black whiskers, and a fine, sonorous voice. His name was Mr. Harker. When we turned into our 12 beds at night, Mr. Harker's bed was drawn across the door. On the night of the second day, not being disposed to lie down, and seeing Mr. Harker sitting on his bed, I went and sat beside him and offered him a pinch of snuff. As Mr. Harker's hand touched mine in taking it from my box, a peculiar shiver crossed him, and he said, "Who is this?" Following Mr. Harker's eyes and looking along the room, I saw again the figure I expected, the second of the two men who had gone down Piccadilly. I rose and advanced a few steps, then stopped and looked round at Mr. Harker. He was quite unconcerned, laughed, and said in a pleasant way, "I thought for a moment we had a 13th juryman without a bed. But I see it is the moonlight." Making no revelation to Mr. Harker, but inviting him to take a walk with me to the end of the room, I watched what the figure did. It stood for a few moments by the bedside of each of my 11 brother jurymen, close to the pillow. It always went to the right-hand side of the bed, and always passed out, crossing the foot of the next bed. It seemed, from the action of the head, merely to look down pensively at each recumbent figure. It took no notice of me or of my bed, which was the nearest to Mr. Harker's. It seemed to go out where the moonlight came in, through a high window, as by an aerial flight of stairs. Next morning, at breakfast, it appeared that everybody present had dreamed of the murdered man last night, except myself and Mr. Harker. I now felt as convinced that the second man who had gone down Piccadilly was the murdered man, so to speak, as if it had been borne into my comprehension by his immediate testimony. But even this took place, and in a manner for which I was not at all prepared. On the fifth day of the trial, when the case for the prosecution was drawing to a close, a miniature of the murdered man, missing from his bedroom upon the discovery of the deed, and afterwards found in a hiding place where the murderer had been seen digging, was put in evidence. Having been identified by the witness under examination, it was handed up to the bench and thence handed down to be inspected by the jury. As an officer in a black gown was making his way with it across to me, the figure of the second man who had gone down Piccadilly impetuously stared from the crowd, caught the miniature from the officer, and gave it to me in his own hands, at the same time saying in a low and hollow tone, before I saw the miniature, which was in a locket, I was younger then, and my face was not then drained of blood. It also came between me and the brother juryman, to whom I would have given the miniature, and between him and the brother juryman, to whom he would have given it. And so it passed on through the whole of our number, and back into my possession. Not one of them, however, detected this. At table, and generally when we were shut up together in Mr. Harker's custody, we had from the first naturally discussed the day's proceedings a good deal. On that fifth day, the case for the prosecution being closed, and we having that side of the question in a completed shape before us, our discussion was more animated and serious. Among our number was a vestryman, the densest idiot I've ever seen at large, who met the plainest evidence with the most preposterous objections, and who was sided with by two flabby parochial parasites, all three impaneled from a district so delivered over to fever that they ought to have been upon their own trial for 500 murders. When these mischievous blockheads were at their loudest, which was towards midnight, while some of us were already preparing for bed, I again saw the murdered man. He stood grimly behind them, beckoning to me. On my going towards them and striking into the conversation, he immediately retired. This was the beginning of a separate series of appearances, confined to that long room in which we were confined. Whenever a knot of my brother jurymen laid their heads together, I saw the head of the murdered man among theirs. Whenever their comparison of notes was going against him, he would solemnly and irresistibly beckon to me. It will be borne in mind that down to the production of the miniature on the fifth day of the trial, I had never seen the appearance in court. Three changes occurred now as we entered on the case for the defense. Two of them I will mention together first. The figure was now in court continually, and it never there addressed itself to me, but always to the person who was speaking at the time. For instance, the throat of the murdered man had been cut straight across. In the opening speech for the defense, it was suggested that the deceased might have cut his own throat. At that very moment, the figure, with its throat in the dreadful condition referred to, this it had concealed before, stood at the speaker's elbow, motioning across its windpipe, now with the right hand, now with the left, vigorously suggesting to the speaker himself the impossibility of such a wound having been self-inflicted by either hand. For another instance, a witnessed character, a woman, deposed to the prisoner's being the most amiable of mankind. The figure at that instant stood on the floor before her, looking her full in the face and pointing out the prisoner's evil countenance with an extended arm and an outstretched finger. The third change now to be added impressed me strongly as the most marked and striking of all. I do not theorize upon it. I accurately state it, and there leave it. Although the appearance was not itself perceived by those whom it addressed, its coming close to such persons was invariably attended by some trepidation or disturbance on their part. It seemed to me as if it were prevented by laws to which I was not amenable from fully revealing itself to others, and yet as if it could invisibly, dumbly, and darkly overshadow their minds. When the leading counsel for the defense suggested that hypothesis of suicide, and the figure stood at the learned gentleman's elbow, frightfully sawing at its severed throat, it is undeniable that the counsel faltered in his speech, lost for a few seconds the thread of his ingenious discourse, wiped his forehead with his handkerchief, and turned extremely pale. When the witness to the character was confronted by the appearance, her eyes most certainly did follow the direction of its pointed finger, and rest with great hesitation and trouble upon the prisoner's face. Two additional illustrations will suffice. On the eighth day of the trial, after the pause, which was every day made early in the afternoon for a few minutes' rest and refreshment, I came back into court with the rest of the jury some little time before the return of the judges. Standing up in the box and looking about me, I thought the figure was not there until, chancing to raise my eyes to the gallery, I saw it bending forward and leaning over a very decent woman, as if to assure itself whether the judges had resumed their seats or not. Immediately afterwards, the woman screamed, fainted, and was carried out. So, with the venerable, sagacious, and patient judge who conducted the trial, when the case was over and he settled himself and his papers to sum up, the murdered man, entering by the judge's door, advanced to his lordship's desk and looked eagerly over his shoulder at the pages of his notes which he was turning. A change came over his lordship's face. His hand stopped. The peculiar shiver that I knew so well passed over him. He faltered. "Excuse me, gentlemen, for a few minutes. I am somewhat oppressed by the vitiated air," and did not recover until he had drunk a glass of water. Through all the monotony of six of those interminable 10 days, the same judges and others on the bench, the same murderer in the dock, the same lawyers at the table, the same tones of questions and answers rising to the roof of the court, the same scratching of the judge's pen, the same ushers going in and out, the same lights kindled at the same hour when there had been any natural light of day, the same foggy curtain outside the great windows when it was foggy, the same rain pattering and dripping when it was rainy, the same footmarks of turnkeys and prisoners day after day on the same sawdust, the same keys locking and unlocking the same heavy doors. Through all the wearisome monotony, which made me feel as if I had been foreman of the jury for a vast period of time, and Piccadilly had flourished coevally with Babylon, the murdered man never lost one trace of his distinctness in my eyes, nor was he at any moment less distinct than anybody else. I must not admit, as a matter of fact, that I never once saw the appearance which I call by the name of the murdered man look at the murderer. Again and again I wondered, why does he not? But he never did. Nor did he look at me after the production of the miniature, until the last closing minutes of the trial arrived. We retired to consider at 7 minutes before 10 at night. The idiomatic vestryman and his two parochial parasites gave us so much trouble that we twice returned into court to beg to have certain extracts from the judge's notes reread. 9 of us had not the smallest doubt about those passages. Neither, I believe, had any one in the court, the dunder-headed triumvirate, having no idea but obstruction, disputed them for that very reason. At length we prevailed, and finally the jury returned into court at 12:10. The murdered man at that time stood directly opposite the jury box, on the other side of the court. As I took my place, his eyes rested on me with great attention. He seemed satisfied, and slowly shook a great gray veil, which he carried on his arm for the first time, over his head and whole form. As I gave in our verdict, guilty, the veil collapsed, all was gone, and his place was empty. The murderer, being asked by the judge, according to usage, whether he had anything to say before sentence of death should be passed upon him, indistinctly muttered something which was described in the leading newspapers the following day as a few rambling, incoherent, and half-audible words in which he was understood to complain that he had not had a fair trial because the foreman of the jury was prepossessed against him. The remarkable declaration that he really made was this: "My lord, I knew I was a doomed man when the foreman of my jury came into the box. My lord, I knew he would never let me off, because before I was taken, he somehow got to my bedside in the night, woke me, and put a rope round my neck." End of The Trial for Murder by Charles Dickens.